What is, because I'm all about the mindset, what is mealtime mindset?
I'd say it's about approaching food from like the mindset principles of like, okay, well, we're gonna think positive, we're gonna talk about food differently, we're going to set ourselves up for success versus that negative, like my kid doesn't eat for me, they won't do it, they're being such a pain. Like there's like a lot of negativity that can really come and frustration and anger and all sorts of feelings that could come up for people about food. And a lot of people have like a history with food. Like maybe their parents forced them to eat foods that they didn't want, or a grandparent, or maybe they had some negative experiences with food themselves as a child, and now they don't have a great relationship with food, right? There can be a lot of different aspects to mealtime mindset, but it's all about changing it really from negative to positive, I'd say, is like the main message there, is that we want to find ways to make our brains understand that food is good and it's safe, right? So sometimes that's for the parent and sometimes it's for the kid, right? And it's usually a little bit of both. I find that like it's really never an isolated incident. Like it's my kid's problem and I'm gonna fix their problem. Well, if it wasn't bothering you and affecting you, then you know it wouldn't really be a problem, right? So because you even think it's a problem, we're gonna have to work on your mindset
Welcome to Functional Moms Podcast, lifestyle medicine for women over 40. Let's age on our own terms. This episode is for parents of picky eaters. Whether you have young children or older teens with limited foods they will consume, we are going to find solutions today.
Christine Marotti Yoder is a pediatric feeding expert, mindset coach, and owner of Foodology Feeding. She is a thought leader in this field and has developed the concept of mealtime mindset, which is a holistic, positive mindset approach to feeding.
Christine has a master's in speech pathology and has taken over 30 courses in feeding that span from infants with bottle aversion to picky eaters, sensory processing difficulties, nutrition, oral motor, myofunctional therapy, sleep disorder breathing, and more.
Wow. Christine, thank you so much for coming on the show today. We hear from so many listeners about their struggles with getting their kids to eat better and more variety. Can you please tell us what is picky eating and is it on the rise?
Sure. So thanks so much for having me. So picky eating is really what I think parents associate with their kids not eating a variety of foods. But if you talk to, you know, your pediatrician, a lot of times they say they're not really concerned about picky eating because when you think about it, there are some developmental stages where kids are just going to be pickier and that is normal. But the types of eaters that we're talking about are more problem feeders, kids that have a very small number of foods that they're eating, fearful to try new foods, don't even sometimes want to touch or look at new foods, can't sit or handle mealtimes, get overwhelmed by smells, sitting with people, you know, going out to eat, birthday parties, vacations. Those become like very challenging situations. And that is not a typical picky eater. That's when you know that there's more of a problem there. So I guess that's sort of like a difference between a regular picky eater. They'll kind of grow out of it. It shouldn't last really more than a year. And usually they're certain time frames. So like 2 to 3, 5 to 6, and 11 to 12 are ages where kids will naturally become picky. It's just like part of like, it goes along with the developmental stage. So yeah, we talk really about like the kids who are more severe. And is it on the rise? I would tell you yes, because we seem to get more calls year over year about this problem. And the types of kids we're seeing are more severe, like kids coming to us who are now down to just one or two foods in their diet. And they're just not eating a variety at all or getting enough nutrients, you know, to support their growing cognitive, etc. Yeah. So I think it's become a real problem. I feel like it's more of like a health concern because kids really need these vitamins and nutrients as they're growing. They're supposed to be learning. Right, and you need all of that to support the body to function as best as it can. So when you only have the same 2 or 3 foods every single day, like how could that possibly be good, you know?
Sure. And I guess my follow-up question for that is, why do you think that this is on the rise? What do you attribute it to? Do you have any theories on that?
I mean, I do have a few theories. My main one actually is really processed foods. So when I was doing research for a book, it's not out yet, but I was researching like the history of picky eating, like when it started. Because if you ask grandparents, they like don't even understand what that is. They're like, no one was picky when I was, you know, young. We never had these types of problems, right? I've heard that before too. But around the time that they started marketing to parents that there's specific child-friendly foods that they should be giving their kid.
Chicken nuggets.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. So parents started buying these like special kid foods. So anything processed, anything that's going to come from a bag, anything that's going to sort of taste and look uniform, a lot of times that those processed foods are much easier for kids to eat. They require less muscle involvement. So I think the muscles get a little bit weak and the kids then start to really prefer those foods that are really easy and soft to break down. So a lot of our picky eaters that come to us, even whatever minimal foods they're eating, they're usually very soft, processed. They might even be like that almost like puff material or bread, sure. Things that'll break down with just saliva even.
Right. So I know that this is your field, but when you say muscle, can you be a little specific about what muscles are you talking about? You're not talking about biceps. I know that.
No, the muscles in the face, right? So especially back here, the masseter muscle. So there are certain muscles, you know, even the tongue has several different muscles.
Wow.
And it has a few different jobs to do, right? So for a typical swallow, right, the tongue actually is supposed to suction to the roof of the mouth, and all the food should be swallowed back in just one swallow. A lot of our picky eaters, we see food scattered all around the mouth. They have trouble moving the food from, you know, the middle of their tongue to the side molars and then back to the middle of the tongue to then do that swallow. So we see a lot of weakness there. And that's very consistent. Like almost every single picky eater has some sort of weakness. Even if it wasn't the original cause of the picky eating, I think that just eating those soft foods over time kind of develops that muscle atrophy or that muscle weakness. But the good news is you can build up that muscle again with some practice.
Yeah, sure. So when you're talking about muscles, you're talking about the muscles in the jawline.
Jaw, and mm-hmm, tongue.
Mm-hmm. Tongue. Okay. You just don't even think as you're describing like the movements of the tongue. I'm like, oh my gosh, like you don't even realize that all of those mechanics are taking place.
No, I wouldn't even think about that. And then also all the foods you're talking about are like what you see on a typical kid's menu. Like if you go to a restaurant, it's like mac and cheese or pasta, chicken tender, like all these soft French fries, like they would all be soft foods that would be easy to eat. So, and that's we're buying too in the store as well, like the easy convenience foods. I can see where the kids would think that that was more, I guess, easier if you're having difficulty.
Right. And I feel like the oral motor piece is often missed. You know, it's something that we're not actually taught about as speech pathologists very well in school. So like all these feeding courses, they're postgraduate courses because they're just, you don't learn about it in depth at all in grad school. So, you know, getting to like know even all of the intricacies of the muscles and the sensory system and like how everything works together. But feeding is the most complex thing your body can do besides procreating, believe it or not. So it involves like all of your organs, muscles, all your sensory systems. So eating's very complex. So a lot of people, we take it for granted. We just think, oh, you just put food in your mouth and then it goes away and you eat it, it's done. But there's a lot involved for sure.
All right. When you say there's a lot involved, so you're talking about the mechanics of the mouth and those muscles that you're talking about. Are you also talking about just like even the digestion of that food and how the food is distributed throughout your system? So you're talking about the whole kit and caboodle from start to finish.
Yeah. There's the sensory system. So there's actually eight different sensory systems. A lot of people think there's just the five, but there's eight involved in eating. And then there's that digestion component. So a lot of kids have maybe not even a full allergy, but a lot of sensitivities to foods that aren't necessarily caught or diagnosed. Very often there's history of reflux, indigestion, constipation. There's a lot of gut issues that go along with it. And when one end of that, your that tube is out of whack, it's going to make the rest of, like, so you might not feel hungry if you're very constipated, right? There's like a whole bunch of different layers that go into thinking about, well, why are they picky? What is going on? Is it just behavior? That's like what we often think or hear, like, oh, they're just being difficult. But a lot of times there's something else right. going on, and it's more than one of those areas.
Wow. I'm just curious as to what are the, you said that a lot of people think that there's just, did you say five or four?
There's, so the five senses, right? But there's actually eight sensory systems. So, well, there's, you know, the normal five, and then there's the proprio.
What are the normal five?
Sorry, the sight.
Just less so that, less, I don't want to assume that everybody knows what
so
that means.
So there's your sight, like visually looking at the food, smelling the okay. food, tasting the food with your mouth, right? There's the touch. Okay. There's your balance, your proprioceptive system. There's your okay. introceptive system, like feeling the foods, like feeling sick, feeling hungry, like that whole system is involved.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's a lot of different.
Then there's, I guess, the digestion is the digestion system.
Your digestive system. Yes, that is a part of it as well. Yeah. So all of those systems, and then all of your organs are involved in the processing of food, distributing the nutrients throughout your body. So it's not like just one little area or one piece of feeding. There's just a lot of different layers and components that go along with,
wow.
you know, putting food in your mouth and getting it, you know, distributed to your body.
We really take it for granted. Yeah. Like you yeah. take it for granted that everything's just going to work great and it's easy and no big deal. Don't think about it.
Yeah. Oh, and then the other one, even hearing, right? right? So you think when you put food in your mouth, it makes yeah. a sound. Sometimes there's a crunch. Sometimes it's soft, right? Some kids have more auditory sensitivities, right? So there's like a yeah. hearing component when it comes to food too. It's just, I know it's like wild.
Oh my gosh. You are so right. Because it's like when my grandson slurps, it annoys the heck out of me. I'm like, it. Yeah. Stop slurping, you know, or gulping, right? And it's like, or there are certain sounds that kind of irk you that, you know, that's really, really interesting. And you would never put all these factors together into, like, there can be so many different hiccups along the way of when you talk about the picky eater and that maybe that kid's not just being picky. That can be.
Yeah. And I think it always is considered more of a behavior issue when you hear about it. It's, you know, the kid is being difficult right. or defiant, you know, those kind of things. So you're really getting to the root cause. And so if you could explain to us, I guess, what are some common root causes of the picky eating?
So usually there's some sort of a disruption along what I would say are like the four pillars. So the gut is one of them. So, you know, like we said, things like constipation, a history of reflux, any sort of sensitivities or allergies to foods. So that would be like one area. The other area is mindset, right? Which is affected sort of by all of those things that we talked about, right? The sensory system, you know, if you're visually, it's like too much to look at, or like you hate that sound that it's making, or being in an environment where there's other people eating and the smells is just so aversive and overwhelming to you, that's going to make you associate food with a negative, right? So that'll affect your mindset about coming to the table, doing mealtime, right? That whole piece. And then there's the oral motor, right? So sure. if you're struggling to eat, if you can't break down food well enough, you know, a lot of our kids with that oral motor, my theory is that when they're chewing the food, if they're left with some foods in their mouth, so we call it like residue, like on their tongue, like there's like food like kind of left over there. If they're left with it and it's, you know, let's say it's a piece of bread, but the bread kind of melts and it becomes like nothing. It's like just mush. But if it's a harder piece of food, like a vegetable that's left behind that or a piece of meat, that can signal to your body like, oh no, like something almost got caught, like it went down your into like the airway. It might not have been a choking incident. It might not have been anything that a parent even would have noticed. But if it was there, like a discomfort, you can, your brain will always try to protect you, right? So that's its number one job. So I think a lot of times if they can't move that food around enough, break it down well enough, I think that the brain is starting to say, nope, that food's not safe anymore. Just get it out of here. And I don't think kids can explain it.
You're almost like a mini trauma. Like you're almost talking like a mini trauma that happened, that then you have this kind of subconscious association negative with the food.
Yeah, that's what I think it is, because our brain really does want to protect us, right? That's its number one job. And your subconscious isn't going to rationalize that. Well, you know, you ate it last week and it was fine, but why is today different, right? So that's why I think even times when parents are like, but I don't understand, you ate it yesterday. Like, why is it today? Like, I don't think kids can even explain it. They're just like, I don't know, I just don't want it today. Like, today's, it's no good anymore. Like, and I don't think they understand, because it wasn't their conscious brain making the decision. It was their subconscious brain.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Fascinating.
What about older kids with picky eating?
Yeah, I mean, I've had adults that I've worked with, but I'll say older kids, it depends on who's motivated to do the work here, right? Because a lot of times at that stage and into adulthood, you're going to parties, you're around other people who are eating. And a lot of times it creates like this social like drama that like, I don't want to be in that environment because I don't want people to see me eating this kind of like baby food over here, or like, oh, why can't you just eat the rest of the food with us? So a lot of times kids will just remove themselves from those types of situations. And then that has like a social impact. So that's sometimes when they want to come to us, is that, okay, I'm ready to work on this eating thing now, because like, I don't want to, you know, stop going to these parties, or I don't want people to think that I'm like weird or something, right? And then as an adult going to weddings and parties and work events, you know, you don't want to be that weird person either. So that we get that again, or sometimes people want to just be healthier and they know that they can't do that processed food, soft food diet. So that's like when we get those people. But it, I think it definitely affects, you know, years of not having all the nutrients you need, I think must have a compounding effect down the line.
Sure.
Do you ever notice if like the older kids, or even like the older adults that may be in this space, because obviously if they're an older adult, they is it something that they would have picked up along the way, or is it something that they possibly would have been living with their entire life? And are they, do they have an awareness about their picky eating, like where it may stem, like associations? Or
so from my experience, they've done this most of their life, if not all of their life, but they don't know why or where it came from. Like they can't tell you like, oh, well, I choked on this food and after that, I didn't want to. I think you might be thinking of is even that ARFID, that I don't know if you've heard that term, avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. I feel like it's like a buzzword these days, but that is almost more of like you had an incident where you choked or something and then like you didn't want to eat food anymore. You were like petrified of eating food. Like, and it sort of almost like came out of seemingly nowhere, but you were eating fine before and then there was like some sort of like an event that made you not want to eat food anymore. And then you had a problem. We've had people like that too. And that's pretty easy to bounce back from when you were eating fine and then, you know, to get over that hump. But most of the time we can trace back that there was feeding issues from even infancy.
Wow. Very interesting. I have to ask too about food allergies. Like my daughter has some anaphylactic food allergies and it's been really challenging because going places, you know, it was always difficult. You had to like bring your own food and she's grown out of some of them and she's done a lot of lifestyle things that have helped. But I will say she had one incident where she had an anaphylactic reaction to a cashew. And then after that, sort of having a lot of food aversions, like afraid to eat in a restaurant, not trusting things that even though we knew prior they were safe to eat. So I'm wondering how that can play into kids. Have you seen some of that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's like a pretty, like a, that's like that food trauma. Like that's a pretty natural reaction. Like you had, and she had like a really bad experience, right? Like that's pretty serious. So some kids have that similar type of reaction, even without that anaphylactic, you know, like more like observable, you know, thing. But I think that, you know, the mind is so powerful that I think it takes a little bit more effort to overcome the mental piece of it. So that's why I do stuff for like working on with the subconscious brain, because I think that that's very important. Constantly doing things like subliminal audio, affirmations, and then just knowledge. Like when kids are older, being able to understanding how food works, how allergies work, what questions to ask, hopefully that'll make them more confident in, you know, knowing, or even just the knowledge if it is an oral motor thing, like, okay, wait, I know that this food might make me gag because I'm not chewing it well enough. enough. Let me spit it out. Let me do a smaller piece. But like even just having that knowledge might make them move forward versus just, nope, I'm not going to do it. I don't want to try it, you know? So as kids get older, I think it's easier to work with them because they just understand more and that you could reason with them a little bit more than like a four-year-old who just won't eat anything because they're scared and they only have two foods, you know?
Wow. I could totally see how that is so helpful, just bringing that awareness so that they can make better choices.
Yeah,
we were just kind of talking about that, right, Kristen, about mindset coaching?
Absolutely. It's such a huge piece in anything that you're trying to do. And there is so much subliminal things going on we don't realize.
Yeah, right. I know. I was like, well, why don't we use subliminal for something positive or helpful instead of like just trying to get you to buy like Pepsi or something?
100%. So let's see. You say that there are three mistakes that parents often make with picky eaters. Can you share what those are?
Sure. Well, I think the number one mistake is probably that they don't know what their kids' issues are. So they might be actually working on the wrong thing or using a wrong approach, right? So if, for example, your child can't move food around well in their mouth and has some sensory issues, you know, doing a behavioral approach like, okay, I want you to lick this 10 times and then you get a sticker or a cookie, like how is that going to address those other issues? So not knowing what their real underlying issues are that need to be addressed, I think is the biggest mistake. And it's a big time waster too. Like we've had parents come to us who are like, we've been in therapy for a year and a half and nothing's changed. And I was like, well, you probably weren't working on like any of the things that you were needed to be working on. That's probably like the big problem.
That's a parent crusher.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you say therapy, do you mean feeding therapy?
Eating therapy. Yeah.
Okay. And so you're saying that they could be doing that, but not addressing the root cause? Is that what you're...
Right. That's what I think happens a lot. And it might be the therapist or it might be just the approach of the like the therapy. Like I said, if you're doing like a behavioral approach and their issue is not behavioral, like if they're not like defiant and not really their issue, then how is doing that approach going to solve like their sensory problem with food or their mindset towards food? You know what I mean? So it's easy to get like caught up in just doing something, but not really knowing why you're doing it.
Wow. I feel like I have, you know, it's interesting. My son didn't have, he was sensitive to foods. I could not figure it out. And he was a little, this was when he was a little guy. He was like 7 years old and he played football and 7, 8, 9, I mean, throughout the years and he'd be running. And then all of a sudden you just see him, wasn't exactly throw up, but it was more than spit up. It was somewhere in between and it would happen all the time. And I'm like, why does this? And it was starting and I took him and they did the camera to look down his esophagus. And basically they said, he had reflux, acid reflux, and they gave him like some type of acid reflux medication. And I'm like, my gosh, I mean, he's 9 years old. Like I, you know, you think maybe of an older man, you know, eating, drinking beer and burgers. I don't know, but not my 9 year old son. And I bought a book and it was so hard. I was a single mom. I have 4 kids just trying to figure out what was going on with this kid. And sometimes he didn't want to eat. I'm listening to you and I'm like, oh my gosh, that was Shane. He didn't want to eat because like before practice or something, because he was like, he was anything that he ate would just come up.
Oh
yeah.
But that's good. So, like he was like listening to himself at least, like he knew, you know, I can't.
That's a good point.
But you know, like, and it's good that you actually allowed him to make that decision because sometimes parents are like, no, like I said, it's time to eat. We're going to eat. You're going to sit here until the meal's done. And then we're pushing them past their point of like, well, all right, this is what my body's telling me, but my mom's telling me something else. And right. So then like, there's like this whole thing, right? But that's good that he like knew like, okay, I know this isn't good for me right now. I think I have to like pump the brakes on food for a few hours. Right.
Right. I mean, I got to say, Christine, that it's so great that you're doing this work because honestly, like I really at that time, he's 19 now. Okay. So that was years ago. And I really didn't have like a clue except for what the traditional, you know, and I'm sure it's not like they were trying to steer me wrong. They were only sharing with me what they knew to help. But at the same time, I started learning that taking that medication was also screwing up his microbiome. And so
I was going to say about that.
Like, I was like, you know, where do you go? And I just never knew that you were even a thing.
Well, I wasn't at the time.
I have to ask, like, is reflux on the rise? Because I feel like when we were young, I didn't really hear of many people having it. And now I feel like so many adults and kids have it. And to Raquel's point, like a 9-year-old, you would think, no, this is like an old dude eating burgers and beer. So it's very interesting.
No, a lot of our kids have either had a history of reflux from NC that maybe has gone away, but they did have one, or they're on actively reflux medication now. And we want to get them off of medication as soon as possible, because that medication usually lowers the amount of acid in their stomach. So they actually have a harder time breaking down and processing food. It actually can make the problem worse. So I guess the better way to do it is to try to figure out maybe what foods or maybe triggers are causing the reflux, and to try to like get that under control, and like, or using like maybe apple cider vinegar. They make like the gummies and stuff. Like there's ways we can kind of try to do it in like more natural way. Same with like the poop, like Miralax is given freely and it really shouldn't be. And that's another one we try to get kids off right away. And there are like definitely more natural ways, like BioRay Pooper. I love that one to try to get.
Whoa.
BioRay makes a little, it's like an herbal tincture called Pooper, and it helps kids poop. But getting to the root cause of like, well, why aren't they pooping? Is it that they don't have enough fiber? Is it that sometimes heavy metals can cause constipation? But like just putting them on Miralax is like not good for their bodies.
Tell us more about the Miralax, because we had another guest recently talking about that, like from a pediatrics perspective, saying that it's not ideal. And that is the go-to for most pediatricians if you have a child with constipation.
Yeah, it is. And it's really, I don't think it's actually meant for children, I think under like 18 or something. There's a whole Facebook group, I think, called Parents Against Miralax on Facebook. And they have the amount of research they have on it is incredible. So you would really learn everything you'd need to know from like their group. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we don't want to, it's a lot of times all of the medications are like a Band-Aid. I feel like you want to try to get to, well, why are they having a problem? I mean, at least for our infants, a lot of the times it's more related to the cow's milk protein, which is really common. I don't know why maybe our bodies are having more trouble processing it than maybe they were even 50 or 100 years ago. Probably just environment and glyphosate and like all of the things. I don't know.
All the things.
There's a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. All the things. There's a lot of things. Jesus, like,
I know.
It's very hard.
It is. You just have to do a little bit at a time, whatever you can manage at the time. But I had another question too. I know you mentioned a strategy that I know I have been guilty of doing is putting something on a child's plate and saying, just take one bite. And that's not read that you did not recommend that. So I'm curious why that would not be a great idea.
Really? I'm really curious about that too.
Yeah. And I mean, that was how I was raised too. And there's something to taking that bite, right? Because when you can get the food into their mouth, then I call it like seeding the palate, right? So you're like getting that food on their tongue, they're getting a little bit used to it. But if they're not ready to do it and they're just doing it to appease you, usually you're not going to all of a sudden like develop them to have this love of that food. In fact, you make it worse and you might make them never want to try that food again. But there is like an easier way to do it. I don't know if it's easier, but a way that hopefully will make them more inclined to want to have more of it in the future, or be more receptive or open to trying more foods. And that is just kind of modeling, letting them go at their own pace, playing with the food and leaving it sort of like up to them when they're ready to taste or try it. We have a lot more success when the kids are the ones initiating. And that's why we actually don't recommend even doing any sort of rewards. Like, okay, if you eat this, then you'll get your cookie. Or if you eat this, then you'll get your Game Boy or whatever it is. Because then they're doing it for that end result and not because they truly are excited or want to do it. We want kids to really want to love food and get excited about food. So they usually do that when they're feeling calm, when they feel safe, and when they're happy. So if we're like putting pressure on them and stressing them out, that's really hard to learn about food in that state. It's hard to learn about anything, right? When you're stressed and the cortisol goes up, that means that your body goes into fight or flight and your ability to like learn, retain, and like develop a love of anything is going to just go down, right?
Yeah, sure. What about in this frame, in terms of like, you're, there's a new food. Hey, just take, you know, try it and see if you like it. If you don't like it, you don't eat it. That's fine. But at least, you know, just give yourself the opportunity to try something and make the decision for yourself. What about that approach?
I think it really depends on your child too. Like, it depends what level they're at, right? So we have, like, in our program, we have levels. So the fearful level, I wouldn't be putting any pressure at that point. But if you have a kid who's curious about food, so maybe they already have 25, 30 foods, then that's not quite as pressure filled as for someone who only has two foods. And it's like, everything is hard and stressful for them, right? So it really depends on like where your child is at with food currently, right? So, or if you have a kid who's like older versus, or like maybe even just autism versus not, like how well they're processing things in general. Like, is that a lot for them or is that no big deal? Right. So it totally depends on your child, I think. But I'm not against it. I would never tell a parent, like, don't do something if you feel like called to do it, you know?
It's funny though, because as you're explaining this, like, I think it has backfired on me. Like, for example, like, my daughter will eat blueberries in muffins, but never just straight blueberries. And so they were like in season. I had these beautiful blueberries. I was like, put a few on her plate with her breakfast. And I was like, why don't you try it? You know, I don't like that. Nope, don't want to. And I was like, oh, just one. And then I feel like I could feel the resistance. Like, I could feel her building a wall against me. And so I totally hear what you're saying. Like, I see how it is not the way to go, probably. And I don't know now at, like, say dinner, would you, you know, if you're plating food, would you plate the food for everybody like the same and then, but not make any comments, like whether they eat it or not, who cares? Like, what would you say on that situation?
I'd say that still depends on their level. Like, a fearful child, you might not even come over to the plate if there's another food on it. Like, it really is dependent. Mm-hmm. Like, that level is very severe, right? But if your child is, well, we have fearful, stuck, curious, and then foodie, right? So if they're like curious and they're like okay with food on their plate, then that's fine. Some nights we do family style. Some nights I plate the food. It's just like whatever seems to work easier at that moment. But there is definitely something to family style. Like, there is that, like, okay, well, we're all going to eat it, kind of control how much is going on your plate. Or, you know, you can just put a few pieces on. And if they're okay with that, great. I would probably, just say nothing. Mm-hmm. They might be like, why is this on here? I'd be like, oh, I don't know. You could just leave it or don't leave. You could eat it or don't eat it, like whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
But a lot of times I find, like, when you're not expecting it or when you're not pushing it, that's when they'll be like a little bit more curious.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm so glad that you brought so much more detail to the different scenarios, because honestly, you know, I was just thinking about like my grandson right now. You know, he can be a little bit of a picky eater, but he doesn't have fears of food. You know, he's not to that. He's just maybe that, I don't know, I don't want to say regular, for lack of a better word.
Like, just typical, developmentally typical picky eater.
Right. The thing, right, the stages, he's probably in some stage. I'm so glad that you brought detail to that, because there's, you know, there are other parents that have a different child. And I just think that you just shed such wonderful light on, you know, the different types of eaters, and that you should listen to your child and assess, you know, like, this may not be appropriate for, you know, my child at this time because they're in this stage, and that there's actually different stages, which I feel like you just mentioned four stages, right? And can you just give a little bit about those four stages?
Sure. Yeah. So fearful, like, you're going to know if your kid is fearful. They eat less than 10 foods.
Right.
They will absolutely not try anything outside of their whatever comes from that box or bag. They're probably very emotional at mealtimes. They either shove food in their mouth in 5 seconds or it takes them an hour and a half to eat. Eating out's probably horrible and challenging for everybody. So you would know if you had fearful for sure. It would be a challenge. Then stuck is like, okay, well, they're probably eating more than like 11 foods, probably like between like 11 and 20 so foods. And you could probably get away with putting the distraction on for them, and they might be able to sit and eat their preferred foods, but they're not going to really try things outside of that. So if you have somebody who likes bread, they might try other breads, but they're not going to try a steak, right? So they're going to kind of keep within their safety foods, but they might explore a little bit. So it's still pretty stressful usually for parents because they're still pretty limited and what they can eat, where they can go. And then you're curious, they're probably eating more foods. They're probably between like 26 and like 39-ish foods. they're probably pretty easy, stress-free for the most part. You might still be a little stressed, but they're probably okay. They could probably sit for a normal meal, like when everyone else is done. And they probably have more variety. They're probably, you know, eating from several different categories of food. It's not quite as hard to go out to eat or on vacation. And then foodie, that's what the dream is, right? They're eating more than 40 foods. They'll yes. try anything. They're not stressed. You're not stressed. You could go anywhere. They don't need a distraction to eat their meal. It's like what everyone wants for their kid, pretty much.
Thanks. Thanks for that explanation. Kristen, do you want to ask about the braces?
Yeah, I just had a thought about braces and retainers and all that stuff because it like they start it kind of young nowadays for sure. And it can be a long process. Like I had kids in retainers maybe in second grade and that one of my kids had two sets of braces. And it does kind of impact on how you're eating. So I'm just curious if that has any role.
Well, it does. I don't know if it does in the way you're thinking it does. So kids that need braces, usually there is some sort of oral dysfunction because their mouth is usually a little smaller if they're needing a palate expander. And that is entirely due to where their tongue is in their mouth. So if their tongue is low in their mouth, like it's just hanging out at the bottom, it's not supposed to be there. It's supposed to be up at the roof behind those front teeth, but back a little bit. And when the tongue is there, resting there all the time, then it forms the palate. So the palate then should be able to fit all of the teeth. So when the tongue isn't there, the mouth actually becomes smaller. And that's when you're going to need palate expanders, orthodontic work. And is that tied into picky eating? Yeah, usually it is. Usually our picky eaters have some amount of orthodontic work that they're going to need. Sometimes that's related to ties, tongue ties. Sometimes it's muscle weakness or just habit that's formed where their tongue is just low. Like if they had extended bottle use or pacifier use, they're used to that tongue being very low. So there's a few different reasons why they might need orthodontic work. I will say the earlier they start, the better because those bones are easier to shift. And I think they said like if you start before they're 8, they might not need braces, but I think it would depend on the severity of it. But knowing that, so here's the whole thing. Like I know I needed all of that. I had tongue ties. My son did too, but my mouth.
Can you tell us what a tongue tie is exactly? Because I'm not totally sure.
Sure. It's connective tissue that's sort of left over. In utero, it's supposed to recede back. And I think it's somewhat on the rise. I feel like a lot of kids have this and that the tissue is not receding back all the way and it's more forward. So it keeps the tongue lower, tethered lower. And sometimes there'll be one on the lip, which can lead to like a gap in between the two front teeth. So when you have the tongue getting pulled down and then it's prompted to stay low and not be at its supposed to be resting spot up at the palate. So that's like the myofunctional part of it that like some of our older kids might also need, like separate kind of from picky eating, but it's sort of related because you need those muscles to eat properly. So they are affected. They're affecting picky eating in some way. Sometimes it's the cause, sometimes it's not. It's very individual, but can palate expanders and braces like cause kids to not want to eat certain foods? Absolutely. I'm sure I rejected some foods that were stickier and chewier at the time because I didn't want it to get stuck in there. And I had literally every type of like head brace, horrible thing. The works. Honestly, yep. My jaw is, I'm permanently deformed at this point. And you might not think like, oh, she looks deformed. But I can't, like, anatomically, to get everything correct, I would need jaw surgery as an adult because the underlying issue was never fixed. My tongue wasn't where it was supposed to be. So the pressures in my mouth were all off. So even though the braces came off, the teeth started to shift again. So that's why it's really important to get to these underlying issues as soon as possible so that you don't have mouth issues for the rest of your life.
Yeah. So Christine, is the tongue tie the little thing underneath your tongue?
It is. It's, well, everyone has a frenulum. It's more of like this place of the frenulum. Like, is it so far forward that it's pulling down the tongue and not allowing it to rest where it's supposed to rest? That's really the issue. So it's more based on function. Like, yeah, everyone has a frenulum, but is the frenulum causing your tongue to not be able to do what it's supposed to do. That's really the key.
See, and I always thought tongue tie, like with breastfeeding, oh, your baby has a tongue tie, that's why they can't latch or something like that. But I didn't realize like you could just have that, right? Like all the way up and discover as an adult that you have it. Is that the truth?
Yeah. I mean, I got mine released when I was 30 years old. So
wow. Okay.
Yeah, I did it as an adult. Once I started taking all the courses and I learned about it, I was like, wait, that's me. I have that. Like,
oh my goodness.
And I had trouble breastfeeding my mom. That was the generation of bottle feeders, right? Everyone did bottle feeding at that point. Yes. So a lot of tongue ties were missed because they just, and it used to be in back in the day, midwives would just take a nail and just like basically like rip it.
Yikes.
But midwives stopped delivering babies. Doctors did, and doctors didn't do that. They didn't know about that. They just said, hey, they're having trouble. Give them a bottle, right? So that's what I mean. A lot of the times our picky eaters, we can trace back. Oh, they had trouble with breastfeeding. Oh, they didn't latch. Oh, they couldn't find a bottle. It took like 10 bottles, right? Okay, well, those are all some red flags that I'm like, well, this wasn't just an overnight. Like there was something here the whole time.
Wow. Wow. I just got to say, and I got to tell today's my daughter's birthday, by
Happy
the way, birthday. She's 26. Happy birthday, Taya. I don't know. The little thing underneath the tongue was almost at the tip mm-hmm. of her tongue, and she couldn't like move her
yeah.
tongue well. And she told me a long time ago, she's like, you know, I think I was supposed to get this cut off, like clipped or something. I'm like, really? I had no idea. Yeah. So you're blowing my mind. I'm like, oh my gosh.
No,
I screwed my daughter up.
You don't know, all, right? But,
yeah. Yeah. But I guess she can still take care of that if she wanted to. Would you?
She can. Yeah. I mean, I would think she probably compensated really well. She probably figured out a way to move her tongue, to get food back, to speak, to.
Yes. But you know what? When you talk about the jaw, she does some things mm-hmm. off with her jaw. I could even see it. Like you couldn't even see a slight, she has a very strong jawline, and I could see a little shift in her jaw. And she's like, yeah, something's off with my jaw. But I'm wondering, like, after everything that you're saying, I'm just like, oh my gosh, like this is like my daughter. She has to listen to this episode.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, this affects a lot of people. So we had one more question about mouth breathing. Does that impact the structure of the jaw? And does that lead to picky eating?
I don't know if it leads to it, but a lot of our picky eaters tend to be mouth breathers because there's that really big connection and like cycle of like, oh, there's mouth problems. Oh, there's eating problems. Like sometimes there's speech problems thrown in there too. Not always, but yes. So, and that goes along with the ties, with the jaw. So what happens is when you're sleeping, if the tongue isn't resting at the top of the mouth, if it's low, it'll fall back into the airway and it'll narrow the airway. And that's where you get like snoring, sleep apnea. So the goal really is, I guess, to get that tongue where it's supposed to be resting on the palate, keeping it up out of the airway so that the airway is clear. Now, there's like, you know, so you can really develop bad sleep apnea as you become an adult. And a lot of times the adults I've worked with for myofunctional therapy, that's their problem. They want to get rid of their sleep apnea. They don't want, or they're redoing their orthodontic work because it didn't work the first time, right? Because the underlying reason wasn't addressed and they wanted to stick this time. So we know, okay, well, you got to fix where the tongue is. You got to fix, you know, all the muscles have to be working optimally if you want to remediate those. But it really depends on how long it's been a problem, because sometimes that jaw will start to come forward and you have that underbite because the jaw is like literally trying to give you room to breathe because it doesn't have enough room because the tongue keeps occluding it in the airway. So yeah, it's really good to get like one of those like orthodontic, the x-rays where they can see like your airway and how narrow it is. That's an issue that would be orthodontic mouth breathing. Like those are myofunctional therapy things that you would definitely want to look into for sure. So to find a myofunctional therapist, you can go to IAOM website and find a provider. That's where I was trained. And then you could be like certified. I'm not a certified one. I just took the training, but there you want somebody who understands like all of those muscles and like what specifically you need to work on to like remediate it.
And so would that be, if you have sleep apnea, is that a solution for it possibly? Instead of just using the CPAP for the rest of your life, is that something you could do?
Yeah, a lot of people do that. Now, I don't know how severe, you know, how long it's been a problem, how severe it is. Okay, are you still going to need it a little bit? Or like, can we completely eliminate it? But I've never had anyone so severe like that. But I'm sure other myofunctional therapists have and could probably give you like a better read on that. But I know for sure. There's actually a great book by James Nestor called Breath. Have you read that?
Oh, yes, I did. Yeah, a while ago. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. That's all about like the airway and the importance of nasal breathing and how it affects like literally everything, our health, our brain, our how ADHD, like, you know, all of those things are related to the breath. And
I started mouth taping after I read that for a little while, but then I stopped. I don't know. In the night I would rip it off sometimes, but they do say it's very beneficial.
It does. Yeah. Especially because you don't really know if you're like always mouth breathing because you're sleeping.
Exactly.
But they do have the tape that has a hole, so you don't have to.
Oh, okay. I didn't try that one. Okay.
I would try that one because then you're not going to feel like, I can't breathe. Like, I've actually put it on my son and he could talk with it. It just gently kind of keeps the lips together. It's just like a little encouragement to like keep them where they're supposed to be.
Nice. Yeah.
Great.
Well, I do want to ask this one last question. And maybe you already answered this earlier, but what is, because I'm all about the mindset, what is mealtime mindset?
I'd say it's about approaching food from like the mindset principles of like, okay, well, we're going to think positive. We're going to talk about food differently. We're going to set ourselves up for success versus that negative. Like, my kid doesn't eat for me. They won't do it. They're being such a pain. Like, there's like a lot of negativity that can really come, and frustration and anger and all sorts of feelings that could come up for people about food. And a lot of people have like a history with food. Like, maybe their parents forced them to eat foods that they didn't want, or a grandparent, or maybe they had some negative experiences with food themselves as a child, and now they don't have a great relationship with food, right? There can be a lot of different aspects to mealtime mindset, but it's all about changing it really from negative to positive, I'd say, is like the main message there, is that we want to find ways to make our brains understand that food is good and it's safe, right? So sometimes that's for the parent and sometimes it's for the kid, right? And it's usually a little bit of both. I find that like it's really never an isolated incident, like, oh, it's my kid's problem and I'm going to fix their problem. Well, if it wasn't bothering you and affecting you, then, you know, it wouldn't really be a problem, right? So because you even think it's a problem, we're going to have to work on your mindset too, which is, you know, we're going to sort of reprogram your mind a little bit to think, you know, this is a good thing. This is a challenge. We're going to overcome it. This is going to be great. You know, just very positive and showing kids that, you know, even how we talk to kids about food or talk about food in front of our kids can really shape like how their perceptions of food and mealtime. So, you know, just changing even things like about what kind of a table you're setting. Like, do you have a table full of clutter? Like, what kind of environment is that? Right. Does it make you want to sit and eat with people, or is everyone fighting at the dinner table? Is it like not a great place to be? Right. So we just like kind of want to look at different like aspects, I guess, of, you know, how people like perceive their mealtime.
Yeah. I love that.
Well, I love that. Well, I just have to share, when you just said that, you just triggered something in me, because I'm just thinking about, you know, when I became a single parent and I'm working, my kids are in school, and then I come home and I'm making dinner and I have four kids, and, you know, I had like four kids in 7 years. Okay. So my kids were all getting ready for dinner. And my thing was, I work so hard. I'm doing all these things. I wanted to have like the Brady Bunch dinner table. Like, we're all at the table having dinner and, you know, we're sharing our day. Like, this is our family time. And, you know, I'm cooking and I'm trying to set the table. And then my kids are all like screwing around and I'm like, we're having dinner. You know, this is supposed to be a nice time. Yeah. And I'm making it a terrible time. And I was like, I was so focused on having, you know, the table made beautiful and, you know, let's pass the butter and not whip it across. What are you doing? doing? Right. Yeah. So, and you know, especially my one son who was so rambunctious, he was like jumping around and I'm like, sit still. And I could see like there was a period in time where I feel like I made that dinner experience a stressful experience.
Absolutely. And I think every parent can relate to that story that you just told. I mean, yeah, I can 100%. I know my husband would say he could. Like, many times it becomes so chaotic and it's not what you imagined. And then maybe even an argument breaks out or, you know, and that's tough.
There were times I actually had to leave. I'm like, all right, I got to take a walk because I was so mad and I took it so personally. I'm like, you're screwing up our dinner time. This is supposed to be. And I don't know. I was trying to fit this image. I don't know why. I don't have no idea why I'm trying to fit this, you know, the Waltons. I have no idea, like something. I'm trying to fit an image. And so, yeah, if that helps any young mom and dads out there, you know, to just chill and like, I don't even know what the answer is because it's such a hard thing. You're trying to, you know, share. I don't know how to manage.
We know the importance of it, right? The evidence, the research says eating families that eat together, it's better for your kids. It's healthy.
Yeah.
So we have to.
I think like not even just putting so much pressure, that has to be every meal. And, you know, I think a lot of times parents don't even eat with their kids because it's just easier to have that quiet time. Okay, I'm going to put a movie on. They're going to sit over here in their chair. I'm going to sit over here in my chair and everyone's going to stay happy, right? But even just doing like a small snack time might be a good way to start. You know, you don't have to make it into the big meal. Like, I wouldn't say like that should be your first goal, right? Like we talk about goal setting in our course, but it's all about like, well, what's like the next step from where you are that we can just move you to, right? Because like, I think that could be like a totally great idea, like a great goal, but that might be unrealistic to go from like no dinners together to like a perfect family meal where everyone's happy and smiling and chatting, you know?
Yeah, you're so right. It's such a good point. And you know, when I think about that season in my life, you're right, because I just became a single parent and we went from, you know, have mom, dad, and disabled to like now we're living in a different place. And it was a little like, you know, uneasy, maybe a little like what's going to happen, what's going on, even for myself. And it was something that we needed to settle to. So yeah, so maybe not. I think I was like trying to force like the dinners that we were having before. And I want that now. I want that.
And sometimes it's not even like you were talking about something so immediate, but sometimes it's really our own upbringing and our past. It's like, well, this is how I did it. And this is how I want it to look now. Or like the opposite, like we never had family dinners. And now we have to have them because like that was wrong. And this is right, or something like that, where you're like compensating for the past or trying to recreate it. So that's what I mean about like going back. And like, we talk about our own, like as parents, our own like food traumas. And like, what are your food memories? Like, was food positive? Was everyone happy and cooking together? Or was mealtime like usually the time that everybody dreaded, because that's when dad was home and he was yelling, or that's when this happened, right? Like everyone has a memory of it, and you hold that with you, and you'll take it with you to your mealtimes with your kids. And our kids can feel if we're stressed and if we're unhappy, and they might not know why. They might not know like, well, that's because mom's unhappy because of this other thing, but they might think, well, maybe I'm doing something wrong, or maybe this time of day is actually horrible, right? So just checking our own stress levels so that they stay calm and relaxed and happy, because they can't have a good meal and learn about food if they're like on edge, because we're on edge, right?
Sure.
Right. I think the point like that I feel when you just said either you had that perfect meal growing up and you want that your family to have that, like you want it to be like you had it, or you never had that. And that's what you want your kids to have because you never had that. That's probably the category I fit in. And I could see that so clearly now. And I guess the thing is like, just be present for where you are.
And just, we're trying to like, you know, we have to drop the perfectionism again. Yes. It's not an all or nothing mindset.
Yes.
Like we always say, you know, and like you're saying, you could start with just a snack together. Like, keep it simple. Like,
imperfect action, right? Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. And it's all about the baby steps, like all of these little tiny, like using all the little strategies and stuff that we talk about. It has like a compounding effect. So like, you know, people give tips on Instagram and people take like some general courses for like the masses, but it's like really not going to be one of those things that's going to like be the magical pill. Like it's just a combination of all of your small efforts, all the baby steps being consistent over time. That's what's going to shift your meals. And that's mindset. When you have that mindset of I'm always making progress, I'm always going to do better, that's when things will happen.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, that brings us to Christine. What are two things a parent can do today to help their picky eaters?
Okay. Well, I'm going to give you two things that are absolutely free. Okay. So you can definitely start this today. Just take off the pressure. Okay. Just don't ask them to try anything. Don't ask them if they like it. Don't look at them expectantly. Like just keep all the pressure off. Comment on something else. The weather, what you did that day, just talk about anything else besides the food will probably be a good way to go. So taking off the pressure is one. And two, getting kids to help you in the kitchen is free and easy, and it will pay off. Maybe not that day, maybe not that meal, but in the future, the more they're exposed to food, right? So again, it's still kind of the same thing. It's no pressure, right? When you're cooking, there's no expectation to eat the food. So a lot of times kids will actually taste food for the first time when they're preparing it. So even if it's just, I just need you to move it from this tray to this bowl, even if that's not part of the step of the meal, like maybe just have them do it just to get them involved in a small, small way. They don't have to help the whole time. That's really hard. But if they can help with like maybe one small part of the meal, that would be a great step in the right direction.
Love it. Those are super simple, really easy to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to tell everybody that Christine has a special offer for our listeners. Receive $100 off her Unlocking Mealtime's Fearful to Foodie Transformation Program. Use the promo code FM100. This program also has a free 7-day trial, so you can access it before paying. And we will link that in the show notes. Thank you so much for that, Christine.
You can connect with Christine on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Foodology_feeding, or visit her website at foodologyfeedingtherapy.com. She also has a podcast called How to Unpicky Your Picky Eater. Love it.
Yeah, no, that's a great one. I have to say I've listened and I think it's really helpful for people. So they should definitely check that out. Thank you so much for being on today. This was a great conversation.
It was. Thank you so much for having me. I hope the parents out there got some like good tips and maybe like some relief that like they're not like doing everything wrong. Take the pressure off of themselves a little bit.
Yes.
Thank you. Well, it certainly helps me. Thank you.
Awesome.
Good. I'm glad.
The information provided in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purpose of diagnosing, curing, treating, or preventing any disease. We are functional medicine certified health coaches and not licensed medical professionals. The opinions and advice of guests are their own and also not considered to be medical advice. Always consult with a healthcare professional when making any healthy lifestyle changes. We would love to hear from you. Please leave a comment or review. Email us at info@functionalmoms.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit the subscribe button.